Hello, hello, everybody. This is Jacob R. Robinson, communication professional by day and podcaster by night. And I have to say, no matter which part of the world you're joining us from, welcome, my friend. You have come to the right place if you are interested and passionate about the field of professional communication. Whether you're a student or an early career professional trying to figure things out, or in the midst of a career change, or perhaps you are an established practitioner with many years of experience in our field, who also happens to be a lifelong learner, this is most definitely the place to be. I, for one, am extremely excited and ecstatic for this upcoming season 2 of the podcast. We've got a chock full list of really great high-profile guests across the board, spanning various expert areas of professional communication and even business functions, from internal communication to PR to strategy to content marketing and research and development. You name it, we got it, anything and everything in between. So don't miss out, tune in, listen in. Feedback is also very much appreciated. So if you enjoyed what you heard, leave me a 5-star review, a comment. You can also reach out to me privately too with your own ideas at jacobrobinson06@gmail.com. I love to hear from my listeners. So don't be shy. And without further ado, let's dive right into this next episode of Progress. We'll see you there. Cheers. I am privileged to be here with Mike Klein. Mike is a data-obsessed internal and social communication consultant with deep interests in developing the field of communication leadership through the WeWe Comms initiative and fastly growing community. Mike is a 30-year communication veteran, as well as a global top 5 internal communication influencer, according to Right Relevance. Mike is presently Iceland-based, with additional experiences from various parts of the world, including Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Great Britain, the Netherlands, and the United States. Mike is the author of From LinkedIn to LinkedIn, the 55-minute guide to social communication, and advocate of the two-question survey as well. Mike has spoken at the University of Belgrade, Reykjavik University, based in Iceland, Quadriga University of Applied Sciences in Berlin, and of course, the IABC, or International Association of Business Communicators World Conferences, spanning New York, Washington, Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver. Mike, it's wonderful to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Having my tea and looking forward to this conversation.
You're having tea. I'm having coffee. It's going to be great. And I'd like to begin by covering some of the origins and your journey. Everybody loves a good origin story. So what led you to internal communication? Are there any light bulb moments or sparks that led up to where you are today that you'd like to share? What achievements are you most proud of?
Well, I started in internal communication, like most people in internal communication, by stumbling into it. Literally, I stumbled into it by reading a brochure for a management consultancy while I was at London Business School getting my MBA and wondering what I was going to do next. And I thought I was going to end up going into marketing or something like that. Then I wrote this brochure about an internal communication consultancy. And I just saw myself in the content. I saw myself in what they were talking about. And part of it was that I had run political campaigns for about 10 years before going to business school. And what I learned fairly quickly is that internal communication is communication that exists within an organization's political dynamic as well as its commercial dynamic. And that just struck me as such a great way to commercialize my previous political experience and move into the corporate world. And I, you know, ultimately I ended up getting a job with that consultancy, an outfit called Smythe Dorward Lambert, which was one of the early large internal communication firms in London. And was with them for a couple of years, and then had the opportunity, or was offered the opportunity, to go create a culture practice for a dot-com consultancy. The challenge with that was that was in 2000, and that was just when the dot-com world was starting to crater. And so I ended up you know, about a year later, going off on my own, doing some really interesting projects in the UK, particularly the merger communication for EasyJet and Go Airlines, which were two low-cost carriers operating in Europe at the time. And EasyJet had acquired Go, and there was a really interesting culture dynamic between the two that I helped bridge largely through effective employee research and by some counterintuitive thinking about how to distribute things like internal communication newsletters and such. And from there, went back to the States briefly and then moved more or less, you know, effectively permanently back to Europe in 2007, taking an internal comms role with Shell for a year and then moving to a number of big corporates and ultimately setting up my own practice in 2016.
Wow, certainly a lot of areas that you've been covering throughout your career. It's very inspiring. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and dive into the Wheelie Comms initiative and growing community that I believe you established in 2020.
2021, March of 2021. So we're just coming up on the one-year anniversary of the two-year anniversary of WeLead Comms. And over the last 2 years, WeLead Comms have built up a followership over 5,000 followers, recognized just under 500 honorees, mostly individuals, but also industry initiatives and the occasional industry event. And also, you know, really created something that filled a void in the existing community of, you know, the existing communications community, because the communications community was really mostly driven by associations at the time. And the associations were going into COVID like everybody else was. And there just seemed to be a huge gap for something that really kind of turned the paradigm around in terms of recognition, membership, and the level of connectivity that people have. And so the idea was just simply to do a single profile of a communication leader every day. And I chose a definition of communication leadership that was completely the opposite of what had been talked about for most of the, you know, the time that we've been talking about communications leadership, which is that if you're taking initiative as a communication professional, you're leading, because the nature of the work that we do involves engaging more than one person, engaging more than, you know, simple actions to actually moving a group or community of people forward. So long as you were doing that, you were a communication leader, whether you're a student, whether you're a job seeker, whether you're a CCO or a senior vice president of an agency. And that in turn created a great pool of people who qualified as communication leaders who could be profiled on a daily basis. And as I started doing this, a number of things started to become apparent. One, there was a much bigger world of communication leadership than just the people who get the annual awards or the people who hold the offices and the associations, and particularly in addition to the people who were based in New York, London, and the usual hotbeds of the communications field. And so I kind of went where everybody else wasn't. So, you know, I went to Kenya and found a good number of people in Kenya. I went to Trinidad and Tobago. I didn't physically go there, but I found people with connections to these places. And one of the things that happened when I found somebody, for example, in Kenya or Trinidad and Tobago or, you know, another small, tightly knit country, is that when I recognized somebody, I got a large number of followers who are other communication leaders in those countries. And so increasingly, it became easier and easier to recruit WeLead Comms honorees from the ranks of WeLead Comms followers, partially because WeLead Comms followers already knew what WeLead Comms was because they were following it. And so, you know, it's become a pretty easy process to find people at all levels of the profession who want to be recognized for their initiative. And so that's how we've gotten to, you know, and there's a large number of people who are interested in these people. and people want to connect with these people. So there's no barriers for people to connect with WeLeadCom's honorees. You know, if you're an honoree, you're being somebody who's accessible to the rest of the community. And so what I'm hearing increasingly is people connecting with each other as a result of WeLeadComms who aren't necessarily connecting through me or connecting through other formal channels. So, you know, we've kind of got a little fusion reactor going within the community of people who are coming in, people being recognized, and people who are connecting with each other. And, you know, that's involved largely zero spend in terms of infrastructure, organizational support. I've had a great sponsor over the last year, Sparrow Connected, looking to create a new sponsorship relationship for the coming year, having some conversations about that. And, you know, really this is, you know, a community that's largely generating itself at the moment.
Here's to the next 5,000. Once again, Mike, congratulations on surpassing.
Thank you very much.
Your 5,000. It's well deserved. And to your point, it's got global impact and influence, which I think is a beautiful thing as well. So well done. And on that note, I think we may have already touched upon this a little bit, but why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about some upcoming sustainable projects that you're tapping into and how you've been fighting the climate battle. I know that you wrote about this in a recent Sparrow Connected article as well back in December 2022 at home and also on a global scale.
I think it's important to distinguish between WeLeadComms and what I do as an individual consultant. The key thing with WeLeadComms is that if you're in, you know, if you're showing initiative as a communication leader, regardless of who you're working for, or where you come from, or what your backgrounds or beliefs are, you deserve to be recognized. So I'm not using WeLeadComms to pursue any particular issue agenda. Now I have my own issues that I care about, and one issue that I do care about is the extent to which communication leaders can be integrated into the whole climate conversation and into the whole social dynamics conversation going on in the world. I hesitate to use the term social justice because that kind of paints a particular view. I mean, the reality is that I'm mostly interested in the future of the communication profession. Now, obviously, the planet has to have a future for the communication profession to have a future. But there's an immediate issue, which is that there are resources streaming into the climate battle. And there's a lot of things that are being invested in that are hugely expensive and hugely intricate. And one of the things that I realized was that we as communication professionals can play a massive role in decarbonizing enterprises, particularly decarbonizing their processes, as well as the behavior of the individuals within those enterprises. And if we were to look at ton for ton in terms of CO2, I would suspect that investment in a core of highly trained, motivated, and, you know, available communication resources who could get trained up in what it would take to decarbonize an organization could produce much bigger CO2 savings per dollar than building big carbon capture and storage facilities and turning carbon dioxide into rock, for instance. I mean, for $10 million, you could build one of these facilities, or you could hire literally hundreds of communication people, get them trained up, get them mobilized, and get them working to common standards within organizations and within communities to take the elements of processes, take the elements of business activity, and really question and change those things which are increasingly carbon intensive. For example, you know, do you need to have, you know, a fleet of cars doing something? Do you need to have, certain activities consuming a lot more resources than they require? Things like that. These are things that, you know, human individuals can think about, synthesize, and then create narratives that drive different behaviors, that drive different processes. And this is stuff, you know, I'm not saying we're the answer to the climate crisis, far from it. But the amount of money and energy required to mobilize us is going to be a lot more efficient than literally trying to pull carbon dioxide out of the sky and turn it into calcium carbonate.
So, Mike, what makes a great internal communication professional from your point of view? Are there some best practices you'd like to highlight or emphasize?
In terms of what makes a great internal communication professional, it depends on what's driving your motivation, your definition of greatness. Do you want to be somebody who's having a huge impact on your organization? You want to be somebody who's seen to be having an impact on their organization, or you want to be somebody who focuses mainly on getting the trust and admiration of senior management? You can do all of these things at the same time. One of the things that will enable you to do this is to get some level of leverage over what you're measured on. Because the extent to which you can drive measures that line up with what you do, the more you can say, look, because of what I did, you were able to achieve what you wanted to do in X, Y, Z occasion. So one of the challenges we face as internal communicators is internal communication pros are not seen as great in the measurement area. And a lot of them don't have a lot of confidence around numbers and measurement. And so they don't necessarily take the initiative to create and agree specific objectives that can, you know, that align with specific things that internal communicators can do. So, for example, you know, you mentioned the two-question survey. The two-question survey is about making sure that in some group of people in the organization, you're asking two questions. What are the top three priorities facing the organization? And what are the three most important things you're doing in your job? And when you ask the question, what are the top three priorities in the organization? You're not going to get three answers. You're going to get a variety of answers from senior management, from employees, and from, you know, middle management in the organization. And the extent to which you can move people in the organization towards an understanding of organizational objectives that line up with what the management's leadership is trying to do, then you can claim credit for the movement in that direction. You're going to claim at least some credit for that movement. In an organization where you're able to embed that approach, you're able to make your own business case, and you're able to demonstrate your effectiveness as a leader. Mm-hmm. In organizations where you can't do this, then you're left at the mercy of measurements that don't measure this. So employee engagement surveys, they aim to measure the temperature, the cultural temperature of the organization. The problem is that the organization is not just simply a radiator. It is something that is moving up and down, left and right, and forward or backward. And you can't measure whether you've reached your destination by the temperature of the airplane. And so if you're going to try to live within the existing measurement structure, then either you need to have some approach that you hopefully will coincide with upward movement across a number of categories that you don't have direct influence of, or you need to be able to build such a socially strong relationship with your leaders that they'll give you the benefit of the doubt, even if those numbers aren't moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of impact, being able to measure your own impact will do a lot to increase your credibility in terms of being a source of impact. If you're trying to measure or demonstrate your greatness in other means, then it's really about building trust and confidence, particularly with those who are employing you. And at the same time, being conscious of the limitations of that approach. So I did a takedown of the Q12, which is considered the gold standard employee engagement survey. And the Q12 asks 12 questions. And it asks a number of them in ways that are designed to get a positive result. So when you're asking a question of a group of people, do you think your coworkers are committed to doing quality work? You know, the number of people who are going to flat out say no or give a 3 to that question is probably pretty small, especially if there's a lack of confidence in the security of the research tool itself. And so on the one hand, you've got X number of questions that are designed to get at least a semi-favorable to favorable response. But then there's the other bit, which is, to what extent do we as internal communicators have influence over whether employees have best friends or whether people in the organization believe they are told about opportunities that take place in the organization? Because this is not stuff that we, you know, internal communication isn't responsible for the manager-employee relationship. We can create a context for it. We can create clear direction about what people are supposed to be doing at a purpose level, mission level, and priority level. But we're not there to sit on a manager's shoulder and tell them what they need to do or not do, or on an employee's shoulder in terms of their own specific job. So I looked at the Q12 and I found that of the 120 points on a scale of 1 to 10, whether they were influenceable by internal communication, I said maybe charitably about 40 of those 120 points are stuff that we can influence. Now,
yeah, that's an eye-opener. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that forces a decision for internal communicators to make. You know, do we focus our activities on trying to get those employee engagement scores up, knowing we only influence directly about a third of that, which means we've got to put a huge amount of effort into making those 40 points work? Or do we say, you know what, let's set aside the employee engagement survey and let's try to figure out what are the things that we need to do that could actually change people's behavior to improve organizational performance. It's hard to do both.
Yeah, and certainly time is a huge factor in that as well, I would imagine.
Time, resources, attention, and the ability to segment and reduce noise to people who aren't directly involved in fixing the specific things. Take, for instance, a change program. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a digital transformation program. You've got a company of 10,000 people. Say of that 10,000 people, 100 people are driving the program, and maybe 1,000 to 3,000 people will have to change their business processes, their behaviors, in order for the program to be a success. That leaves you with 6,000 people who need to know that the program is going on, need to know in case their activities are going to be impacted, when they're going to be impacted and how, and to have enough confidence that the organization is going to take care of this and not necessarily pepper the leadership with questions and, you know, insecurities about, is this going to cost me my job? So right now, internal communication strategically is not really geared to do this. You know, and also you've got change program stakeholders who have informal employee KPIs who aren't really interested in the fact that only 1,000 people are really impacted by what's going on. They want to send the PMO minutes to every employee. You know, and you look at artificial intelligence and the developments in the AI field, and we've gone from the internet, which largely has democratized distribution, to AI, which democratizes content generation, and it can allow you to bypass existing distribution channels. If you can pull together your own distribution list, you don't need to go through some gatekeeper internal comms person who doesn't have any interest in your KPI of telling the whole company about your program. So, you know, we're looking at a situation here where you've got rogue stakeholders who want to, you know, who want to engage everybody equally. But then you've got a need to make sure that the people who are focused on this thing do the right things, and then other people focus on what they're supposed to focus on. And the extent to which internal communication and organizations have resisted the segmentation of internal audiences is arguably the single greatest blockage to our effectiveness as a profession.
Mike, thank you for sharing all of this. And you did touch upon the artificial intelligence piece. Moving forward, do you think that would be helpful or harmful to IC? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm actually organizing an AI workshop for communication leaders in on the 21st of March. And the point of this workshop is to really move people beyond the thinking about what is this going to do to my job or my function? And think more about, what is AI going to do to the enterprise and how can I actually help lead and convene the AI conversation in my organization? Because the reality is that AI will have some impact on the work that communication folks do. We will find it easier to develop basic content, to target content, to conduct research. We'll need to become better at strategy. We'll need to become a lot better at measurement. We're going to need to become much more agile in the way we engage both the employee audience and the leaders. Yes. But the thing that we need to realize that at the most is just as our own area is going to be going through a major transformation, every other part of our organizations is going to be going through a similar transformation at exactly the same time. So take, for instance, legal.
Yes.
Legal produces a lot of content. It's in the form of contracts and it's in the form of memoranda. Yeah. And AI tools are going to be extraordinarily well positioned to produce draft contracts, draft documents, draft memoranda. And this is going to be extremely dislocating to the legal, the legal practices of corporations and to the really to the legal profession, because a lot of work that's been done by junior people is going to move from being done by those people to being reviewed perhaps by more senior people. And so there's engineering produces hundreds of pages worth of reports in organizations and communities. Finance produces a ton of reports, a lot of charts, a lot of graphs, a lot of PowerPoint slides. All of this stuff is going to be moving to a much greater degree of automation much more quickly. And then you look at the whole digital transformation agenda of organizations, the extent to which some of those processes can be short-circuited by these off-the-shelf AI tools, is immense. And what's likely to happen is that the approach that we've had to managing technology change has been a very linear and process focused approach.
Yeah.
When we can make these changes happen without having to go through those processes, then if communication and particularly communication leaders can't take hold of the context in which this stuff is happening,
yeah,
then it's just going to be tactical change interfacing with tactical change interfacing with tactical change. And the potential for chaos in organizations is going to be immense. So communication leaders are extremely well positioned to try to make sense and navigate it in front of this chaos before we get to real deep understanding of how all of these interfaces are going to affect each other. And the focus moves away from the context towards fixing the interface problems. So there's a huge opportunity for us. And it's not going to be a long-lasting opportunity if we don't seize it, within the coming months.
Right.
You look at how companies have normally handled the introduction of new technologies. It's been through the IT departments. It's been through the need for compatibility with Microsoft or with Google or something like that. And, obviously Microsoft is becoming a huge player in this space. And, and that's going to be another big factor going on in the background. But the more that we can make this about context and organizational purpose and organization and navigating,
yes,
rather than managing, the better chance our organizations will have to take advantage of this stuff rather than being bogged down by it.
Yeah, it certainly reminds me of cutting through the noise, because there's certainly a lot of noise going around. But
it's interesting that you mentioned noise, because when I interviewed C-level executives a couple of years ago for a research project I did for communication platform vendor, the one thing that they were saying consistently is that they want internal communication functions to take the lead in managing noise in their organizations. And to a large extent, this is something that some people talk about, but that's not really been taken on as a mandate. They focused on well-being. They focused on employee engagement, focusing on a lot of things that aren't really in our direct ability to handle. Noise is actually something that is in our ability to handle. Mm-hmm. And it is something that, you know, that the senior leaders are watching. And with AI, the ability to not necessarily manage down the noise, but to create, you know, an overarching theme to it, that the noise becomes less salient, because in the absence of context, everyone's going to focus on little bits of content and focus on what's in it for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Self-interest is always a factor as well that we have to be aware of. Mike, just a couple more questions as we sure. round out this episode. I would like to give you the opportunity to share a little bit about your book as well, From Lincoln to LinkedIn, which I've read as an early career communication professional. And there was one quote in particular that stood out to me, and it's certainly one of my favorites, and that is that inner networks are the arms, legs, size, and ears of a network communication strategy, bridging the gap between the lines and boxes of the organizational chart and the conversations of the real organization. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it's, you know, there is a natural tension in organization between the formal organizational structure and the power that people derive from their positions in hierarchy.
Yeah.
Versus the power that people derive from being trusted sources of information and people who are seen to be doing the right thing within their organizations. And the opportunity we have as communication leaders is to bring those two closer together and ideally bring the hierarchical side closer in touch with the reality that's taking place between people in the organizations. Now, there are ways to do this. There's organizational network analysis, which is driven by, you know, looking at the relationships between individuals. Because what happens is when you've got, say, 10,000 people in an organization, about 300 people will connect most of the conversations in the organization because they'll know what's going on, or they'll know the right people, or they can connect the right person in one space with the right person in another. And organizations have been largely blind to this. A lot of them have been willfully blind to this. A lot of them have basically said, you know, we don't want to know. We don't want to be on the hook for knowing this. We don't want to invade people's privacy. You know, the extent to which people have privacy in a work context really hasn't been fully bottomed out yet. But there's been an unwillingness to explore in a lot of organizations. And part of it is that when you create a set of facts that says this is what your organization really looks like, then those who have to act as if the hierarchical structure is the way to go, you know, is not the way to go, but the way things actually work, you know, feel that they could have their authority undermined by the existence of this other knowledge. So there's a lot of concern in organizations about this, but the payoff that's available to organizations is substantial. If you can communicate, you know, deep, rich, contextual and content rich knowledge to 300 people instead of bombing 10,000 with it, your ability to manage noise, to operate efficiently, and to resolve problems by putting the right people together rather than by raising the profile of problems.
Yeah.
Becomes, you know, your ability to compete as an organization becomes a lot stronger, particularly if you've got leaders who are actively backing the approach and willing to acknowledge the realities that are unearthed by these, you know, by this research. Now, there's another way to do similar research, which doesn't have as much organizational turbulence cause, which is something called snowball analysis, where you find 20 or 30 people in an organization, you ask them where they go for professional advice, news about the company, or moral support. You then ask those people where they go, and eventually the same names keep showing up on the list. And so you don't get that precision that you get from organizational network analysis. But what you do get is a more impressionistic view in a group of people that you can start from without having to ask 10,000 people where they go for the news that they seek in the organization. Yeah. So, and the latter work is actually work that I do. The former work, there's a couple of firms that specialize in this. If you're interested, you can get in touch with me and I can tell you where to go for this. But the other side of organizational influence is it's also one of the things that gets ignored most when there's M&A activity or mass layoffs. And so what happens is you arbitrarily either restructure organizations on the basis of what looks great from an org chart perspective, or you say, okay, we need to get rid of a third of our workforce, and you don't take into consideration the connectedness of the people that you're removing. Because what you do in that case is if you remove your most connected people, you end up paralyzing the parts of your organization that are trying to reconnect and reload after the big layoff or after the big change. So the amount of damage that you do is actually far higher than the amount of money that you're saving by moving some salaries off of your books. And if you do this research and you do it ongoingly and it's not seen as just simply prep for a layoff, you'll have a much better idea of the people you desperately need to keep. It's not necessarily the people who are seen to be high performers, because a lot of what you do in a job is not just simply the tasks that are tasked within your job, but to connect the teams and connect the functions so that the whole organization moves smoothly and powerfully.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of intangible forces at work as well that must be considered.
Yeah, because some of the networks that create in organizations are not created because of functional or financial drivers. You know, people who are, you know, I'm a big Tottenham supporter. I mean, I've been a Tottenham supporter for 20 plus years. And I know who, you know, when I was working in British companies, I knew who the other Tottenham supporters were. I'd have lunch with them. We'd talk about the team. We'd talk about the last game. And then we might talk a little bit of shop after we do that. And so somebody I wouldn't normally talk to in engineering or manufacturing or something are the people who I'm actually closest with socially. And so if I, you know, and that's just me, and I'm hardly, you know, the, you know, most of the time I've been a consultant working on an embedded basis in organizations. People who've got 20 years in an organization and have social connections as a member of a community, as a member of an underrepresented community, particularly, they're going to be driving a lot more cohesion in your organizations than you would normally expect. Yeah, it's another reason why it's important to take things like employee research resource groups seriously, because they're a great way to connect your social networks beyond the limitations of boxes and lines in the org chart.
Check out Mike's book. Once again, that's From LinkedIn to LinkedIn.
If you're interested, send me a note and I'll send you a copy. I've got it in PDF. It's free. Got the rights back from the publisher a few years ago, and I'm much more interested in getting the word out than in trying to make a few bucks on this book. So if you want a copy, let me know and I'll send you a copy by email. It's mike.klein@changingthetherms.com.
Awesome. And one final opportunity here, Mike, for you to give some shout outs to some fellow internal communicators in your immediate and extended networks.
Well, I'd like to shout out to the internal comms people who are making a difference outside the English speaking world, because we all know the people who've been at this for a while, who've got their websites, who've got their, you know, their programs going, what have you, you know, people based in London, people based in the US to a certain extent. I want to shout out some of the people that you've probably never heard of who are making a massive difference in this profession. We've got Ali Foreman Chuck in Latin America, who's got his own internal comms network that's, you know, it's a hugely impressive group that he's got going. Two of the best minds in internal communication in the world are Carsten Rossi and Georg Kolb in Germany. And there's an amazing crew that's emerging in Denmark right now. Jonas Blot Hansen, Anders Monrad Rentorf, Katrine Ningrone, and also in-house people like Thomas Grundorf, who actually contribute to the conversation that's going on in the profession. You know, there's a really neat group that's emerging in Denmark that has global insights, but that's developing them in a very unique and powerful way. And also, you see people in Eastern Europe, like Inco Club in the Czech Republic and Tijana Bijatovic in Serbia, who's got an IC network focused on that part of the world. And you know, there is a much bigger IC world and there's a much bigger comms world. When we look at, you know, people like Andras Stanislav with the international, with the ICCO, I mean, there are massive groups of people in the comms profession outside of the usual locations who are making a huge difference, who people should be paying attention to. Most of these people do a lot of their work in English, so language isn't a barrier at all.
And links to their profiles will be provided in the show notes as well. Mike, an absolute pleasure having you on. For our listeners, how can they follow you? What platforms would you like to share?
Well, start with We Lead Comms on LinkedIn. That's hashtag WELEADCOMMS. My own LinkedIn page is kind of where I organize my world, and you can find me at MKLEIN818 on LinkedIn. And if you want to message me, that's probably the best place to do it. You can also reach me on my email, which is mike.klein@changingtheterms.com.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, as they say, time flies when you're having fun. This has been another astounding episode of Progress. I'm your host, Jacob R. Robinson. And if you have listened up to this point, I would love to hear from you. Drop me a line. You can reach me via email, jacobrobinson06@gmail.com, with your ideas and feedback for future episodes in terms of content, programming, subject matter, areas of exploration, and even a guest or two that you would like to see featured on this podcast in the near future. Do be sure to leave me a 5-star rating and a comment as well. And again, if you enjoyed what you've heard, share the podcast with your networks. Your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing you again in the next episode of Progress. Until next time, cheers.